This is episode number 754 of the Secret Identity Podcast. Today on What's New, we're going to talk about Connecticut GamerCon, Marvel announcing the X-Men Blue and Gold teams, and Matt's recent appearance at Broadbrook's The Book Club. Our comics this week will be Punisher Annual number 1, Web Warriors number 11, The Creeps number 8, and Supergirl number 2. And this week's Boob Tube and Big Screen Bonanza is all about the Boob Tube as we talk about the crossover between the CW TV shows based on the Invasion storyline.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you!
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
Good, clean, wholesome fun.
And welcome, everybody, to Secret Identity. This is Brian LaTendry here, as always, with the lovely... the beautiful, the always charming Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
I'm loving the compliments. And every time you start, I just soak them all in.
I came in today. You're wearing your Amazon branded sweatshirt.
Yes.
I am. For anybody that knows me, I wear sweatshirts almost all year round.
Yep.
That is my, if hockey jerseys and canvas sneakers are your uniform.
Yep.
I would say that hooded sweatshirts are probably have become my uniform over the past few years. So anytime I see a good hoodie, and that is a nice one, a nice blue and white, and blue, white, and yellow are my favorite colors.
And those are the classic colors. When we were kids, you either had a blue one or a gray one.
Yes.
And
it's funny you mention that because the two sweatshirts that I wear the most now, like to work and everything, one is blue, one is gray.
And usually what I'll do is I wear a lot of hoodies at work because I'm on the dock and it gets a little cold, but I still want to wear my shorts. So I will have a hoodie and then throw a cool t-shirt on over it.
Yeah. See, for me, I don't have any hair anymore. So frequently I'm also wearing a hat, a knitted hat, a cap, if you will. But a hoodie is always good to have around when you have a bald head.
Yeah. And it was interesting you said that because this week we do spirit weeks at work.
Yep.
And it was silly hat and crazy socks week.
Oh, really?
To get ready. Next week is superhero week, but I don't have crazy hats because I don't wear hats. I couldn't find my Wampa winter cap.
You couldn't borrow one from one of the girls?
No, I couldn't. Becky couldn't find her TARDIS.
I was going to say Pokemon because she used to be huge into Pokemon.
Yes, and for Christmas I got them, speaking of book club, which we'll talk about a little bit later, but I got two knitted caps. You know how the girls love the knitted caps?
Oh, I love the knitted caps.
And it's a Pokeball.
Nice.
And I got them both. And my daughter, it was my youngest, it was interesting. With my mother-in-law passing away a few weeks ago, they are still, both of daughters are still huge into Pokemon Go.
They're well, and not only that, but you had Sun and Moon that just launched on the 3DS.
And my youngest was like, is it wrong for me to look for Pokemon in the funeral home? And I said, not at all. Knock yourself out. Have fun. I don't know if she found any.
I don't know if she found any either. I haven't played Pokemon Go.
Yeah. Oh, they love it.
My son actually is into it, and he's never been into Pokemon other than a brief period of time where I think I grabbed him some cards at a comic show that we were at, probably in the 10-cent bin or whatever, and he was on a kick for like a week where he collected the cards. Didn't play the actual game, just wanted the cards with all the monsters on them, which is totally acceptable.
And that's the right way to do it because Becky, when she was younger, did the same thing. She couldn't play the game, but hey, here's my Charmander card.
Yeah, I do like I've dabbled in the games on the Nintendo handhelds, the Pokemon games, but Pokemon was a little bit after my time, so I never got into it the way that a ton of people got into it as like their role-playing game of choice.
And it's still huge because I work with a bunch of 20-somethings that all still wear Pokemon shirts to work, all have Pokemon backpacks, and one of the pit drivers, who was a forklift driver, always wears a Charmander hat, or not Charmander, a Pikachu hat.
Well, if you're a Pokemon fan, particularly of the video games, Matthew, then you might want to attend the Connecticut GamerCon April 1st and 2nd of 2017. If you go to ctgamercon.com, you can get more information, but there is going to be gaming tournaments. There's going to be arcade machines. There's going to potentially be some of the new consoles that are on the market, and tons of games, lots of stuff still be announced. But our buddy Mitch is putting together a very exciting show, and I'm extremely excited about that because we just had the PlayStation Experience this past week where they announce, you know, upcoming PlayStation games. We saw trailers for The Last of Us Part 2, a new Uncharted story game, a ton of other stuff. And then we have the upcoming Nintendo Switch. We just got a new Final Fantasy. We, as we mentioned, got the new Pokemons. So it's a good time to be a gamer.
And there's a Warcraft game out right now, I believe.
Well, there's always a Warcraft game out.
And the reason I know that is because a couple weeks ago we had orders at Amazon to pull 10,000 of these games.
Is it an expansion for World of Warcraft? Because
I
that could be...
don't know.
Huh.
Because we were talking, like, everybody was like, Warcraft? Yeah, and everybody who has younger kids go, oh, yeah. One of the managers goes, oh, yeah, my son loves this game.
I know every time they release an expansion, it's huge. But I've never been into Warcraft. But Blizzard, who makes World of Warcraft, also makes Overwatch, which is a huge game right now, and I adore that game. And so, which I'm sure there will be tournaments for that at the upcoming Connecticut Gamer Con as well. But we will keep talking about that and keep giving more information out as it comes along. In other news this week, Marvel announced, well, actually it was last week, the X-Men Blue and Gold teams. Now, I have not been following the X-Men news for quite some time, but as you and I have talked about on the show, there's always a new opportunity to try to get into the X-Men every time they do a new event or they reboot the line or whatever the case may be. I don't know if this is them acknowledging that the Inhumans didn't quite become the X-Men 2.
As they hoped.
As much as they had hoped. But we have heard that we're getting an Inhumans TV series, so it's not like the Inhumans are going away, but it seems like the X-Men are kind of getting put back out in the spotlight a little bit more. So, as part of the Resurrection...
Oh.
See what they did there?
I like that.
The next big X event for the year, the X-Men are going back to their classic blue and gold teams, first seen back in the 90s. Now, did you read that back then?
I never read it, but I know about it.
It says because, and this is, by the way, the beat that I pulled this news from, because everybody loves the 90s. Each team will star in their own book as the X line gets an overhaul and a bunch of new number ones. Gold's creative team is Mark Guggenheim and Adrian Sayaf, and Blue's Cullen Bunn and Jorge Molina.
Those are two really good teams.
Two pretty good teams right there, yeah. The mutants will be split between the teams, just like in the older days, sort of like Raw and SmackDown.
If you need to use that, yep.
We assured the future is bright for the X-Men, however, so no worries. Following an era where the X-Men were on the back foot, fighting for the survival of their species, we wanted to take a moment to exhale and indulge the kind of big, beautiful, colorful stories that portray the X-Men at their best, says editor Daniel Ketchum. In a return to form, with spandex costumes rather than body armor, softball games on the school lawn, and the X-Men on a proactive mission to be the greatest heroes of all time to human and mutant alike. It all kicks off in X-Men Gold number one as creators Mark Guggenheim and Adrian Sayaf bring together the X-Men's biggest guns for an all-new adventure. Kitty Pryde has returned to Earth to find the X-Men in shambles. Now, aside there, I think she was part of the Guardians of the Galaxy
for
a little while. They survived their war with the Inhumans, but at a great cost. They've earned their future. Now what are they going to do with it? Kitty takes the reins and assembles a team of the most iconic X-Men to her side. Storm, Colossus, Nightcrawler, Old Man Logan, and Rachel Gray. They are the X-Men, and they're here to take mutant kind into the future and make the world a better place. Then, fan-fave creators Cullen Bunn and Jorge Molina bring the time-displaced original X-Men together once more in X-Men Blue number one. With Jean Grey at the helm, Cyclops, Beast, Iceman, and Angel will set out to embody Xavier's dream to foster a world that no longer hates and fears them. But they'll have help from none other than Magneto.
Uh-oh.
Magneto?
He's back?
Why would these X-Men ally themselves with the man that they once swore to defeat? Can the former mutant terrorist truly be trusted? The X-Men are young, but they aren't stupid, Matthew. Keep your enemies close, after all.
And it's very funny because they still, it's like, the arch enemy. Well, for a lot of people, when they were reading X-Men, he was part of the team and a friend, not the bad guy from the 60s and the 70s. He was part of the team. So it's interesting that they're still using that because when you said, you know, their arch enemy, he hasn't been their arch enemy in an awful long time.
I kind of like the very comic booky feel to what we just read there.
I do too.
So I could probably say, oh, I'm not going to buy any of that, but I'll probably buy the first issues of both of those
series. I'll give it a try, because I know you and I have spoken about this, that we desperately try to include ourselves in the X-verse. They just don't want us in there.
Here's what's going to happen, Matthew. I'm going to buy one of those issues. You know what? Let's each buy one.
Yes.
Because the first thing that's going to happen is I'm going to pick it up. I'm going to see that it's a $5 cover price.
And I freak out.
Correct me if I'm wrong, because they don't list any prices there.
Nope.
I can guarantee this is a $5 cover price. I'm going to be like, I can't believe I'm spending $5 on this. And if it's not A++ when I read through it,
that'll be
the only issue that I'll be buying of that particular series, which is basically, unfortunately, not to go down that rabbit hole again, that's kind of where I'm at with Marvel right now.
Same with me.
I pick it up. It's $5 for number one issue. That seems to be almost the standard now. And if comics were on a short leash before, a $5 cover price is the shortest of leashes.
And I have completely cut myself. I'm probably getting 5 books a week now.
Really?
As opposed to the 10 or 12 I used to get. I'm being very selective. And one of the things that I'm doing, and I'm trying to put together just a little story about this for the website, is with the DC stuff, since it's biweekly, I started to realize I'm kind of falling behind in two or three of the books. Like
it's easy to fall behind.
And what I'm going to start doing now is I'm going to stick with the Supermans and the Batmans, because those are my go-to books, Justice League, Flash. But with Aquaman being a biweekly, I'm going to start picking up story arcs. I'm going to pick up a 4 or 5 issue arc of that particular book. I'm going to do it with Green Lanterns because I gave up on that one. And the book I'm trying out this week is Suicide Squad. I got the first issue and thought it was okay. People are raving about it. So I'm trying to do things like that to read a little bit more, but not get caught up in the I have to have them all. Just reading what I like. And if I don't like the Aquaman arc, I just won't get it anymore. But I want, because I do enjoy what a lot of them are doing. And right now I'm getting a lot more of the monthly books because the bi-weeklies are kind of tough.
Yeah, for me, I've seen a big hit to my Marvel pull list. My DC pull list has increased, and my indie books, and I say indie, I basically mean everybody else has completely increased. Like I just read the latest issue of Lake of Fire last night. Man, that series is freaking amazing. Giant Days, Revival, which is coming to an end. What else am I reading right now? Lumberjanes, the Escape from New York, Big Trouble in Little China series from Boom, Goldie Vance from Boom, the Archie stuff from Dark Horse. I'm trying to think of what I'm reading right now. The heck am I reading from Dark Horse?
I got Usagi, War of Tanks.
World of Tanks is the new one, right?
Yep.
I think I have the first issue of that. I was just reading a Dark Horse one the other day. In any case, Marvel down, DC up from where it was pre-rebirth, and lots of other stuff.
I'm really liking taking chances, and one of the books I'm going to be talking about in a little bit is a book that I can't say taking a chance on, because I loved everything about it.
I mean, you look at the cover, it's not much of a leap for Matthew Herron.
Yeah, I looked right at it and said, oh dear God, this is my childhood all over again.
Nor would it be a leap for me either. So speaking of bookstores, Matthew,
yes.
You were at a bookstore this past weekend because you are everywhere.
Yeah, not as everywhere as I used to be, but I decided to take a trip back to the old hometown of Broadbrook, Connecticut, and a great store called Book Club, where you can get all sorts of great used books, great atmosphere. Cindy, who owns it, is amazing, and she had 5 or 6 artists or writers in there, and a crafter who was making those knit hats that I was talking about.
I saw your pictures that you posted on the old Facebook.
Yes, and it was a lot of fun, but one of the books that I picked up was a poetry book. I interviewed the writer of this, Joseph R. Adamovicia, and I pronounced it right on the interviews both times. And he was like, wow, usually people screw that up. And I go, wow, usually I screw it up.
Like, I never mess up names.
But I screwed it up right here.
For 100.
And Joseph is a poet. And I was completely fascinated by everything about poetry, talking about all the different styles. So I picked up the book, A Step Into My Heart, which has got some really, really, really cool stuff on it. And it's very political, very heartfelt, very much pointed at the daily life of where we are right now and where our emotions are. And it was really cool because when we were talking, I was like, so does a major event or something like the political climate in this country make you start rhyming? And he said, absolutely, that's what it does. And he goes, I do a lot of open mic poetry. And I'm like, holy crap, I kind of forgot all about that stuff. So he talked to me about all the different types of poetry. But the book is really cool because you have A Step Into My Heart, the regular one, and then you flip it over and you have a Step Into My Heart, the Blackout edition. And he explained in the interview what blackout is. But what blackout poetry is say you get a newspaper and you black out a bunch of lines in that particular story.
You create from what's already there.
Yes.
Yes.
And when I was flipping through this, this completely freaked me out to no end.
It's pretty awesome. Yeah.
Because I'm thinking, you have really got to be looking at words very deeply to find something in something like that.
Imagine a word search, but your job is to create a poem that comes together.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you'll be hearing the interview in a little bit. I'll put a review on the website, and I'm trying to find where he is. But if you go to Joseph Adam Avicia on Facebook, Adomavicia, Joseph R., you'll be able to hook up with him. He's got all his stuff there. But yeah, crazy, crazy stuff.
And how was your appearance in general there?
We did okay. There wasn't like tons of people that came in. It just seemed to be an off day. It was a very nice day out, and a lot of people are still trying to pick up their leaves. But we had a great time. Everybody there all got in touch with each other and kept start talking with each other. I think I did 4 interviews while I was there.
Nice.
So I'll be able to hand those out and let everybody hear those. Picked up a couple books from the people that were there. One was a guy who wrote a book about wartime in Springfield during World War II, which is fascinating.
Yep.
And then another guy who was there was him and his dad do a paranormal show. So I did an interview with him, and the names are escaping me. I apologize. But really cool stuff. My good friend Jim Taylor showed up. He's doing a signing there next week. And he signed a bunch of books for me because I do have a big book signing this weekend.
Nice.
At the Pandorica in upstate New York.
That is right. Now that is on Saturday?
Saturday the 10th.
Yep.
So hopefully I'll see you there. And as you're hearing this, it's obviously over.
Actually, you know what? We're going to put this up Friday.
Yes.
I'm glad you brought that up, Matthew. So this will go up Friday. So if you're hearing this and you want to go to the Pandoricum and you want to see Matthew at his book signing, you can do that. Normally, we, on a great week where we get 2 shows done, we're posting Monday and Friday.
Yeah.
What's been happening is because we've had a couple weeks where we couldn't record, I've been putting them up on Friday instead of the following Monday, because that way you're not going an entire week without any show at all. And so I did that last week. The show went up on Friday. So if you're looking for it on Monday, it's already up.
Yep.
But if you are looking for something to listen to on the weekend as you're going out and doing your holiday shopping and all that kind of stuff, or maybe you're taking a long drive to go to a book signing.
Yes.
You can listen to that. So this episode will be up this Friday.
And we are going where we went to see Striper. So it's like a couple blocks away from that.
At the Chance.
Yes.
In Poughkeepsie. We should keep an eye on what shows are coming to that place.
I have been.
Oh, you good.
Yeah,
all right, good.
I've been keeping track, seeing who's coming, because there's a lot of great 80s metal that is making its resurgence. And apparently a friend of mine in Brazil got tickets to see Helloween in February or March. So they've already started announcing South American dates.
Right. But when they come here, we will be hitting that for sure. That's a done deal.
Yes.
That is absolutely happening.
Yep.
Yeah. That's our 2017 for sure. Lock it down. It's happening concert.
And UFO and Saxon.
That's right. They're coming to the Stafford Palace. Is that where?
No, they're going to be. I wish they were coming there. That would be great too.
Are they coming to?
The Brixton Music Hall, which is outside of Boston.
Oh, okay. All right.
It'll be fun.
Well, there you go. You got a little music minute on top of that. So we are going to jump into talking about comics now, but let's give a quick shout out to VikingOilsLLC.com, because as the weather gets more crisp, and we've even seen snow over the past week, the beard continues to grow.
It does.
I am at the point now where I'm getting both looks of pseudo-disgust, but also nods from people like, that my beard has now reached respectable levels where people who appreciate beards are giving me the nod of, you know what, I like what you got going on over there.
And everybody who appreciates beards are going to appreciate VikingOilsLLC.com. It's where you can get all the great stuff from oils to beard balms to t-shirts to powders, all the things that'll make your beard look nice. And ladies, if you're looking to get something for your guys, it fits perfectly in a stocking.
It sure does.
Yes.
It absolutely does.
I was cleaning up my car and found my beard balm.
There you go. I actually might use some on Friday because I have to go to an event at my son's school.
There you go.
So I'll have to take off the hoodie. I'll have to get rid of the knitted cap for the day. I'll have to probably put on a button-down shirt and some khakis, and which I should be wearing to work anyways, mind you. Keep in mind, if you saw what my average daily outfit is right now, you'd be like, First of all, you would think that he probably doesn't work at all.
This guy does what?
Yeah, but he doesn't work at all. But if you ever came to my job and saw that everyone else is dressed appropriately and I am literally dressed like it's Friday night, yeah.
So I know what statement we're going to be hearing so much at this thing you're going to be at tomorrow. Do I smell lanolin?
Yes. I forget what the name of the one that I'm using is.
Odin's Blood? Is that the one
blood
you
Blood something.
Yeah.
And
Blood. I got the blood one too. I got the beard
balm.
Great
stuff.
Yes.
It's great stuff. All right. Let's talk about comics, Matthew. And why don't you start us off with The Punisher? Because you are actually more caught up on this series than I am. I am behind
yes.
in this series.
Now, sadly, with Steve Dillon passing away, the look and feel that we have loved in the first arc is no longer going to be there.
But I didn't hear that the series got canceled, right?
No, because they're doing, I believe there is an ad in here. Yes, Punisher number 7.
Okay.
And it doesn't have any information on who the creative team is, but I'm sure you can
if
go
If I
on
could
and...
make a suggestion, although I'm sure that Becky Cloonan probably doesn't need anything else to be added to
her
plate.
Draw it.
But she could write and draw this book.
Yes.
And her work, no one will be able to touch Dillon's iconic look
nope.
on The Punisher.
Mm-hmm.
But as someone who was doing the book with him, to then be able to pick up the mantle and carry it forward in her style, which is amazing.
Yes.
I think would be fantastic. However, she probably has a billion projects going on, and that's probably not realistic.
So I thought that this was the first book in the new, because I think that's how they're doing it too. They might be doing like, okay, it's done. Now we're going to go to number one and kind of start this arc.
It's like
and
arcs.
Then doing number
yeah.
one. Yeah. So I just saw The Punisher number one, great cover of a Scarecrow with a Punisher shirt and a lit pumpkin jack-o'-lantern on his head. The logo is in orange, and I thought, this is going to be good. So I picked it up, and then after I got home and started reading it, I realized it was an annual. I usually stay away from annuals, although somebody told me, John told me at work, the Superman annual, I need to go and get it.
Huh.
So I've got to go back and pick that one up. So I might go tonight to go get it. But this one's written by Jerry Conaway. Felix Ruiz is the artist. Color is Lee Lothbridge. Letters, Corey Pettit. And the cover is by Huzzah. And that cover is Huzzah. So we start out in Carbon Works Detroit on Halloween. And you see some dude is just getting beat up by a bunch of other dudes. And as they are smacking him around, a van pulls up. Guy gets out. And as they're beating him up, it looks and sounds like they're beating up a street guy. Because they're like, you smelly piece of blah, blah, blah. And they're like, you know what? Look when I talk to you. And as they're looking at this guy, and they all have skull masks on. And one of the guys is like, Dave, we ought to look up. And you see, it is the Punisher. And it is interesting that one of the guys there has got the Punisher mask and a Punisher shirt on, and now they are standing right in front of the Punisher, and he is standing there full bore with a machine gun and rounds and looks at the guys, and they slowly let him go, and Punisher yells at the kid with the Punisher shirt and says, take that off. Kid rips it off, throws it down. The guy that is, the guy that they were beating up now takes it, and they walk away. So now you go on top of the roof. And there's a guy up there doing some surveillance, and a phone rings. And the guy looks a little bit like the Punisher. And you see it's an incoming call. It says, Mom. And the guy's like, hey, Mom, I can't talk right now. And he's like, where are you? And he's like, I'm working. And she goes, please don't lie. And he's like, I'm not lying. And she says, you know what? You need to come home. Roger called, said he didn't show up for your shift today. He's worried about you. He's like, Mom, I'm all right. I'm fine. She said he hasn't returned your calls. He's like, look, I've been busy. And she says, doing what? And as you hear that, you hear, brat-a-tat-tat-tat-tat, and you see a light up. All these people are dead in a room, all these bad guys. And she's like, you haven't been home for days. What's going on? And you see that this guy is really struggling with some stuff. He gets in a car, and as he starts to drive away, the Punisher walks out of the room that he just shot up of all the bad guys, gets in a van, and drives away. And now you go where this guy walks into that room. And he goes up to one of the guys going, tell me what you told him. And he's like, I can't breathe. And he's like, you tell me what you told him. And the guy's like, I'm not telling you nothing, you cop. And he's like, look, whatever you told Castle, you can tell me. And you're dying anyway, so you might as well tell me. And he's trying to find somebody. And you find out later on as you go through the book that this kid right here, his father was a cop who was killed. And he also grew up, and I believe he's Muslim. He grew up kind of being made fun of all the time. And his father was like a super huge, awesome cop. So he was struggling trying to live up to the expectations of him as he became a cop. And you see that there's another party at the Institute of Arts where it's a costume party. There's a guy in a bow tie and a suit with a Galactus helmet on. And all these people are dressed like that. And then the waiters all throw all their stuff down and they get ready to kill all the people there and rob everybody. Punisher shows up and just starts shooting everybody. And it's great because it's like one of those scenes from Commando where – or not – which one was just on? The spoof one. Hot Shots. Oh. You remember the scene where he used the machine gun and shot up like 100 bad dudes?
Uh-huh.
And there were like 3 civilians there and – all the bad dudes fell and the civilians were just standing there.
Uh-huh.
It seems to be like that, where he just takes down all these guys. He grabs one of the guys, brings him out, and he's like, you know, I want you to tell me what's going on here. And he's like, where can I find your cousin? And, you know, he's like, I'm not telling you anything. I'm not telling you what's going on. And as this continues, you're getting the flashbacks to this young guy being a cop and working with his dad. And you see that they're trying to find a drug dealer. And this drug dealer is the one who ended up killing his dad. And what they're doing is they realize that the cops are getting closer. They realize Frank Castle's getting closer. So it's Halloween night. And every time a group of kids come in to knock on the door, trick or treat, they open up the door and they grab all the kids. And now they have like 50 kids in this room saying, yeah, if the cops try to come in, we're just going to start killing you guys. And it is pretty creepy. It is pretty bad with that part of it. So they're all in here. And then somebody shows up saying, hey, man, I just got to let you know the Punisher's looking for you. Everybody's looking for you. That cop's looking for you. And as they go in, as this is all going on, they start to go in the other room. And the guy's got a girlfriend. They walk into the room. And now she's all tied up. And they're realizing that the Punisher is now in this room. So the Punisher goes in to start doing this, taking out all the guys. The cop shows up, starts taking out all the other guys. And they finally get the one guy, the guy who killed the kid's father. And there's a kid in a Halloween costume. He's dressed as Howard the Duck. He's got on a tie. He's got on a broken down hat and a really crappy looking beak on his mouth. So they take him out. The bad guy is out there. He's the only one left alive. And the police kid goes up there and he's like, you know what? You killed my dad, so I'm going to take you down. Punisher walks out and is like, look, you can't kill this guy. This is not the way to do it. You're not going to bring any honor. He goes, I knew your father. I knew your dad. Your dad was a great guy. He wanted more to you than this. You don't want to be doing this because I know what it's like to live like this. If you do this, you have now committed murder and it will ruin everything that you've stood for with your career. You have a mother you need to take care of. You need to go back to the police force and be that cop that your dad wanted you to be. And he's like, you know, this is crap. I can't believe you're doing this. And he kind of guilts the guy into just getting up. He goes, you want to kill this guy in front of all these kids? And the guy's all pissed off, bent out of shape. He goes, you know what? I know it's hard. And I believed in your father and I believe in you. And the kid just gets disgusted and storms away. And the Punisher's like, oh, good boy. Glad you left. And then the guy turns around and in front of all the kids, Punisher just shoots the dude. And, you know, then the guy turns around going, why did you do that? And he goes, well, I killed him, not you. So he's dead. You're set. You're all free. And then when the cops show up, he is there. And then you got to see, he's going to have to suffer for what he did. But a very good story. I don't usually buy annuals. I wouldn't have bought it if I knew it was an annual. But since they write annual really small now,
right,
almost as small as the price.
Hey, look over here. Look over here.
Yeah. I mean, look at this. It's right there. It's so friggin' tiny.
Yep.
I didn't even notice.
Notice how big the number one is, though.
Oh, that's huge. That is huge. And it was a really good book. Great story.
$5, you said?
$4.99.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So great book, great story. And then that's when I didn't realize it was an annual until I read The Punisher number 7 on sale in November. And I'm like, wait, what? And
then flipped over now
and saw it was. But I do have a code. And let's hope that I don't rip this sucker out. It's colder out, so we might not be able to. Oh, we got it.
Whoa, that was good.
Yeah, and let's see if I can read it. So you can go to marvelcomics.com/redeem and type in FZML67TY901N.
I like how you made that an adventure.
I don't even know if that's
question.
Right.
Some of those were a declaration. That was great.
I don't even know if that's right, but well, if it is right, you'll be able to get
it. I have
a book.
Code for this book too, which I'll be talking about in a second. So if that one, if they don't get that one, they can get this one. Let's talk about Web Warriors, Matthew. This was a book that spun out of Spider-Verse. Mm-hmm. And as I was looking at the cover here, which basically has just tons of different Spider-Men and Spider-Women from all over the multiverse, I keep thinking to myself, like, I can't believe this is where things are at. Like, when I got back into reading comics, when did the Clone Saga happen? It was early 90s, yep. Right? So I think I got back in – what brought me back in the first time was Spider-Man 2099, right? So, of course, he's right in the middle of this cover, even though he's not wearing his original uniform there. But to think about now, we're at a point where there is a Spider-Verse book where all of these Spider characters from different universes are in the same book together is just – I believe I've said it before. It's an embarrassment of riches, Matthew. Mm. Sadly, we're one less – book richer now because this is the final issue of Web Warriors. Now, I can't remember if this was designed to be an ongoing series or if it was designed to end. My thought is that it was intended to be more of an ongoing because what book ends at issue 11?
Yeah.
Usually it's 6 or 12, right? Maybe an 8.
That's an odd
something
one.
Like that.
11's
odd. End at 11. Anyways, what's been happening in the latest arc of Web Warriors is that for those that don't know, there was one surviving member of the family of hunters that was killing all the spider characters. And his name is Karn, and he has become sort of the watcher of the web of life and destiny, which is the web that connects all of the different universes. And the Web Warriors are a series of spider characters from throughout the multiverse who work together to basically, it's like a Quantum Leap-y type of thing, solving problems, like a Legends of Tomorrow type of thing, solving problems together. Well, what they've been dealing with in this latest arc is an army of Electros. So you had spider characters from all these different worlds. Now you got Electros who are out causing havoc, and they have been dealing with them. But in doing so, the team ended up getting separated, and the web ended up getting damaged. And so we're at a point now where the Electro army is still fighting with half the team. You have a couple of characters, Spider UK and Mayday Parker, which who are sort of stranded together. And then you have some other characters who are now sort of making an assault on the web itself. So everything is kind of coming together. And we start off on Earth 90214, where you have Harry Osborn, who has taken out Spider-Man Noir and Pavitar Prakbar and taken them out. And he has decided that he is going to destroy every strand of the web. And the Harry Osborn of this world is sort of part goblin, part spider. And he says, I'm going to destroy the whole web. And so he has now captured the two of them. He's going to go back to the web. He's going to try and destroy it. Meanwhile, over in Earth 803, you have the war going on between the Electros and the spider characters. And I will show you the two-page spread.
Very cool.
Very cool. And by the way, this book is written by Mr. Mike Costa. David Baldion does the pencils. Walden Wong, Scott Hanna, John Dell, Lorenzo Ruggiero, and Terry Pallett are the inkers. The colorists are Matt Yackey, Andres Mosa, and Rochelle Rosenberg. Our buddy Joe Caramagna letters. The cover artist, Julian Totino Tedesco, and it is a fantastic cover. And Devin Lewis is the editor of this book. And so you've got the Electro War sort of going on there, and these characters are fighting to a standstill. And one of the characters is the gigantic spider mech. But the Electros have taken it over. And so it has sort of swung the tide in their favor, and they are battling back and forth, but the spider team is losing. And you have one of the spider characters is Uncle Ben from a particular reality. And he figures out what they need to do, and he's going to use a device that a other dimensional Dr. Octopus named Octavia created, and it's the Mind Swapper device that R. Otto used on Peter when he switched bodies with them. So she's created a similar device. He's going to use that and take over the consciousness of this robot that the Electros are controlling. So as that's happening, you have this Harry Osborn guy who shows up at the web, and he is going to destroy the entire web. So you've got these two parallel things going on at the time. Well, as of course, because this is the last issue, Ben ends up getting to swap minds with this gigantic robot, and he ends up stopping the rest of the Electros. And his consciousness is now part of this robot, and he has sort of quelled the war that's been happening. But as they have done that, and even though they've won that day, the Harry Osborn character has damaged the web to the point where all of the different universes are starting to sort of come together, and reality is having a big problem, and it's sort of smashing together. And so the only way that they're going to be able to stop that is to stop Harry from damaging the rest of the web. And the only way that they can do that is they have to send a signal out from the world that they're on that will reverberate through the entire web of life and destiny. And the way that they decide to do that is they're going to use this giant mech, Spider-Man, as a humongous amplifier. So you have the Spider-Punk, who is a punk rock Spider-Man, and you have Gwen, who is a drummer, and they team up and they plug into this thing and they start playing rock music, Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
And the signal of their rock music reverberates through the web and fries the Harry Osborn that was damaging the web, thereby saving the entire multiverse, Matthew.
Wow.
They saved the universe with rock and roll.
That's the way it is.
Which, that's a good way to get me to like a book, is to have some sort of heavy metal or rock and roll related yep. solution to a problem. And so they, in fact, are able to do that. And that's how they wrap up this particular arc. So as the book winds down, you have the team agreeing that even though they've won the day here, they need to always be on call for problems throughout the multiverse, and they're going to be ready should another need arise. And that's kind of the way that it ends, with the Web Warrior saying, we'll still be around. We're still going to be a team, and we're still going to work together. And that's the way the book ends. And then you get some nice stuff from the creators in the back where they're talking about how fun it was to work on the book. I'm guessing this book got canceled before its time. I have enjoyed it, but then again, I'm an easy sell when it comes to spider characters. I liked the premise of the Exiles, because when I started reading comic books again, that was one of the books. Mm-hmm. And I think even in the early days of Secret Identity, that was a book that I was really
yep.
into.
It was the Spider Tours or the World...
It was the World Tour.
Yep.
So that was so I had read some earlier issues of the Exiles. And then when I came back in the 2000s, I was reading the Exiles. And that was like the first bringing back of Spider-Man 2099, is when they did that World Tour. And I was super stoked about that. That was pre any of this stuff happening here, which was really, really cool. But the thing about Web Warriors is that while the premise was great, spider characters from throughout the multiverse dealing with problems that come up in the multiverse. Awesome premise. I don't feel like they did enough with that premise. And I think part of the problem was that you're taking on these big story arcs. And this is a book that spun out of a big event. I would almost like to see 1 to 2 issue story arcs, or even 1 issue story arcs. Like, this to me is a book that you can have. It's basically a team up book.
Yeah.
So you can do these one and done stories where you're going to this particular world. It's like an episode of Quantum Leap, dude. You go to the world, or Sliders or whatever. You go to the world, you solve the problem, you go to the next world. Go to the world, solve the problem, go to the next world. Like, every week is a new adventure. Every week is a new world or something like that. And so getting bogged down in larger story arcs, to me, for this book, was a little bit too much for this book, because this book should be boom, 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 boom. So hopefully, if they're going to stick around, and I know they're going to be appearing in Clone Conspiracy and stuff like that, we'll see the Web Warriors again. I would like to see them in a, you know, that what if Marvel team up sort of one and done type of story format, because I think that would work better for this type of book.
Yeah, very good stuff. A book that I picked up at Barnes & Noble, flipping through, because I can get some comic books there, and a lot of books that I don't get at my store I can find there. And I was flipping through and saw a magazine called The Creeps. And it's on number 8. And I said, oh, you know what? It's 8. I don't know if I want to get it.
As the completionist, you're yep. like, I'm not jumping in at issue 8.
Yep. So then I walked away and then went back and walked away and went back and walked away and grabbed it and bought it. And
here we are today talking
about it. Here we are today. Now, The Creeps is definitely not a spoof, because spoof is the wrong word for it, but it is an homage to Creepy Magazine and Eerie, which were the two premier science fiction and horror magazines of illustrated work in the 70s and into the early 80s. And they were by Warren Magazine. And what The Creeps is very much in line with that. The stories, the size, everything, the layout, the logo, even the company. The company here is called Warrant. So instead of Warren, you've got Warrant.
Right.
Smells great. Smells like print, like old newspaper print, because that's pretty much what they're using in here. It's a magazine-sized book. And the cool thing was that it is $4.99 a copy.
So for as much as you paid for the Punisher annual,
yes,
you got a horror magazine.
And I got way more out of that than this one.
Uh-huh.
Or the other way around.
Vice versa. We know. Yeah. We speak Matthew Herring, okay? We know what you're talking about.
So this one is edited by Rich Sala. The cover is by Kenneth Smith, and it is amazing. Now, the artist in the issue, Alex Nino, Nick Pulaski, Musar Daman, Reno Marquis, Doug Dubish, and M. Ramlan. And the writers, Don Glut, Nicola Cudi, Lloyd Smith, and Artie Goodwin. Now, these are – there's one, two, three. There's like seven or eight stories in here, and I'm not going to go through every one of them. But you start out with a great letters page, which are always fantastic. And if you do it right where you're answering – as the certain character, and the character in here, he's the old creep.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of the Crypt Keeper, you got the old creep.
Or Uncle Creepy.
Yep. So that's, and that was, I think Uncle Creepy was for yeah. Creepy. So you got him in there, and there's all these things about, oh, I love the magazine, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, you'll get your, the old creep will give you his replies to it all. Some great things in here, some contests, some TV suggestions. And then, just like in the old magazines, the first page before the story is, this is how you can buy all the other issues and you can subscribe. So I'm looking to probably get a bunch of
and
these.
You were because, like, gee willikers, I'll complete my collection.
Perfect. The first story is called The Talking Dead, art by Nick Pawalko and story by Don Glut. Now, this is just perfect for what the stories used to be like. It's a guy who's a ventriloquist, and he's given his performance, and the people in the audience are like, yeah, we've seen this before. This is terrible. And there's a guy backstage. He's got a big hump on his back, really scary looking, and he is doing the voice because people are like, you know, the show's terrible, but you don't see his lips moving. That's pretty cool. That's because he's got somebody off camera, off stage, doing all the stuff for him. And then it says, after the performance, it says, Hugo, Edgar, into my office. No! So they go in there, and the boss is saying, look, Your show is old. Your show is dated. People aren't coming in anymore. And if I'm going to keep the theater running, you need to make sure that you are doing something fresh, because if people aren't coming, you guys don't have a job. So they walk outside after they get yelled at, and they walk over to a bridge, and the guy throws his dummy right off the bridge into the water. And he says, well, he's not going to work anymore, so we got to do something different. And as they're walking, you're seeing this thing called the Stalking Dead, where and then in the movie Marquee over says Fright of the Living Dead. So you have all these Walking Dead zombie
sure,
references.
Nods to Easter eggs to things that you would know.
And this little kid starts freaking out when the goofy, monstery looking guy of the two goes by. And he's like, the guy goes, oh, wait a minute. I've got an idea. So he goes and he gets this new dummy, and it's a zombie dummy. And the guy goes, that gives me the creeps, which is perfect tie-in for the cover of the book, name of the book. So he's going through, and they go through this whole routine, and the routine is a huge hit. People are freaking out about it. But the problem is that the guy who's behind the scenes doing the voicing is not happy with the ventriloquist on stage, who's not really even a ventriloquist, walking away with all the honeys, because he's walking out with two honeys. And this is not making the other guy very happy. So the theater owner calls him up and says, hey, you know what? You're a smash hit. I'm going to raise your salary. But you know what? What am I going to do? What am I going to do about your Edgar friend? He goes, well, you know what? I'll tell him that we're not going to get raises and he won't be the wiser. He's like, oh, you know what? Sorry, it's going to be business as usual. They're not giving us a raise. And he's like, well, you know what? I think everything changes. And the guy goes nuts, picks up the dummy, smashes the dude across the face with it, ripping off half his face, and then beats him to death with it. And then on the next page, you have that typical ending where the
O. Henry ending.
The guy calls up and he's like, hey, boss, I think that Hugo, he's gone. He left. I don't know what's going on. He's like, but you know what? I can maybe give you another act and we'll see what we can do. He's like, all right, well, whatever you want to do, give it a try. And you see everybody in the audience is going, oh, what's that stench? And it says gasp, choke, wrench, and or wretch. And then you look up and you see that the monstery looking dude now has the dead dude on his, he's got his hand up his back, and he's making him the ventriloquist.
Yep.
That's how the story ends. There's one about To Their Wormy Beds Are Gone, which is a story about this couple that they exorcise ghosts. But the problem is when they exorcise ghosts, you're basically evicting a ghost out of their home. So you're putting these ghosts on the street, Well, these ghosts now decide that when this lady and her husband buy a house, we're going to haunt that house and we're going to take care of them. That's how that goes. You have a story about called Roseblood, about a demon that comes in and starts doing all sorts of bad stuff. You have Rat Wars, where you've got – it's a sort of a sci-fi one with these two guys that crash on a planet as they're fighting rats. And they are looking for the only water on this planet. And as they reach for it, this big monster comes up, grabs them, and kills them. And basically, Mr. Creep says, this is why you can't live on another planet, because everything wants to kill everybody. The Wishing Well is about the witch hunts. And the final story, which I really, really enjoyed, Head of State, which is about a guy that wants to live forever. And he does these heinous, horrible things. He's taking over the world in like the early 1600s. And he says, you know, I never want to die. And he has a curse, or he thinks it's not a curse.
Right.
It's a curse.
It's a blessing.
You're going to live forever. And they chop his head off and they put it on a pike. And now he is going to travel the world as the sign of, hey, we just beat this main guy. So that's how the whole book ends. And some really cool ads in here. There's a thing about the Frazetta Museum in Pennsylvania. There's a big horror convention going on in Pennsylvania, so I'm assuming the book is from Pennsylvania. But a great book. I'm definitely going to be picking these up. If I can't get it through the comic store, I'll have to make sure I'm going over there. But it's quarterly, too, which to me is a perfect investment.
Nice.
Perfect.
$5 a quarter, not bad.
Not bad.
There you go. All right, well, I'm going to wrap up today with Supergirl number 2. This is a book that I think is familiar enough to people who are watching the television show that and I think it's becoming more familiar, and we'll talk about how they're sort of shaping it a little bit here. But we start off in the Fortress of Solitude, because in the last episode, Kara ended up running into Cyborg Superman at the Fortress of Solitude. And Cyborg Superman is saying to her, I'm your father. I'm Zor-El.
Interesting.
And so she's like, of course you're not my father. I've fought you before. You're evil, all this kind of stuff. But as they're fighting, she is hearing from him things that only her father would know. And so at one point, as they're kind of battling, she's saying, you can't be my father. Zor-El's dead. He saved me from Krypton's destruction. You know, I fought you. You tried to kill me. And he says, I wasn't myself then, but I am now. And he says, you know, I want to help you. You're my daughter, Kara. That's my duty. And so he stops fighting her, and he's saying, look, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to rebuild – is it Argo City?
Yes.
So he said, I'm trying to rebuild Argo City. I'm trying to give you your home back. That's why I'm here. That's why I have sort of come back for you. And she is not believing him, and she keeps trying to attack him. And he's saying, look, I'm restoring Argo City for you. Don't be, you know, an impulsive kid and – not listen to me. He says, you know, you don't belong on Earth. This is not where you're supposed to be. And she's fighting him and saying, you know, nobody can bring Argo back. You're not my father. And he says, are you sure? Look at your reaction. Look at your anger. And he apparently has this thing in his chest called the Sunstone. And I don't know why it's giving him his power or essentially what it's doing, but he's able to, again, know things that only her father would know. And as she is kind of battling him, the drone that he's in, the body that he's in, just kind of blows up. But he keeps saying to her, I'm your father, and I'm trying to build Argo City, and I'm trying to bring you home. And as she destroys this thing, she's saying, it can't possibly be. And so she goes home, and she's kind of dejected. She's back in National City. She's working with the DEO, the Department of Extranormal Operations, which is just like the Supergirl television show. And so she's doing that here, except here you have the woman who is pretending to be her mother, Eliza, and she is an agent of the DEO. So as opposed to the TV show where I think that they sort of adopted her, I don't know if they were working with the DEO at a time or not, but it seems less familial here.
Yeah.
Like here, they were two agents that basically get assigned to her, and she knows that full well the entire time. However, you're starting to see this motherly relationship develop between Eliza and her. And so she's been doing this work for the DEO, and she's talking to one of the criminals that she had arrested there. And you see that she is in high school, which is what's different than the TV show. In the TV show, obviously, she's in her obviously in her 20s yep. now. She's out and about in the professional world. But then the question becomes, how do you bring Cat Grant into this series? And so what you have here is you have at this National City Technical High School, where she is a very talented student, but is sort of struggling with when to speak up and when not to speak up. And everything is different here in terms of technology. And she's kind of getting used to that. And so there's kids in her class that thinks maybe she's not that smart because she's having so much trouble adjusting to this particular school. But you have Cat Grant who comes here and she is there because she is starting CatGo Worldwide Media. So you're sort of seeing her start this new venture. And she's saying, you know, I've watched the world at its worst and I am ready to do my best to change it. The Young Innovators Program is a key to that. Today, one of you demonstrating exceptional perception and foresight will join my Young Innovators. So she's kind of offering a job to a high school kid at her new CatGo Worldwide Media. And what happens is she says, I want you to answer one question. Whoever gets this question right is going to be the person that gets to work at my place. What is CatGo's biggest obstacle for success? And Supergirl's kind of sitting there and she's not saying anything. And of course she's dressed in her civilian clothes and everything. And another kid in the class ends up speaking up and he says, is it Cat Grant? and she says, you know what? Welcome to CatGo. Because that's the type of answer that Kat yeah. would want to hear. And what they did a great job of in here, and I didn't mention this up front because, of course, the credits are – oh, there they are. Written by Steve Orlando, artist by Brian – art by Brian Ching, colors by Mike Attier, letters by Steve Wands, and the editor is Paul Heminsky. And so what they did a great job of in this book is capturing Calista Flockhart's voice as Cat Grant. Mm. And she just comes across exactly like you remember her in the TV show. And that's where I think, like, again, even though the initial choice was to set this book in high school, you now have CatGo coming in, you know, have that stuff kind of happening. And so the cool thing is that, and there's also a conversation between Cat and Kara that happens much like it did in the show with the whole mentor thing. So what happens is after this assembly where this other kid gets the position, Cat runs into Kara in the hallway. And she says, you, I know who you are. And Kara's like, oh my gosh, Miss Grant, you know, I'm Kara Danvers. She says, I know, I'm a personal friend of Terry Kurtzberger. She showed me your application for her physics prize. So she knows one of the teachers at the school. She says, I'm going to tell you something. You're one of the smartest people in this building, but I saw you in there. You were about to speak and you doubted yourself. And in that instant, someone else stole your moment. Life is about action. The minute you begin to doubt yourself, you fall in with the herd. And so that is exactly very something much. That you would hear from Cat Grant to Kara in the Supergirl TV show. And so I think that if you got the first couple issues of this, you know, the rebirth issue and then number one, and you thought, this doesn't feel like the TV show, I think we're quickly drawing enough parallels here that you could get this book and see some familiar stuff. And so now in National City, you've got CatGo, where Kara shows up the next day and she runs into this kid from her class. And he's kind of like a rival to hers. But what the rest of the issue is basically about is she's going home and she's still hearing her father's voice. And apparently when they fought, he, as Cyborg Superman, like put a sliver of himself like embedded in her hand or something like that. And he can speak to her and he can show her stuff. And he's showing her time that she spent with her mom. He's showing her, you know, what happened. And he's showing her that when everything was falling apart, he ended up submitting to Brainiac, basically. And that's how he became this sort of cyborg Superman thing. And in doing that, his own will and his own consciousness got overwritten, but he fought that. And so what he's trying to explain to Kara now is that, yep, I might look like that. Yes, I made these bad choices. However, I'm myself again. And in being myself, I want to rebuild Argo City and I am rebuilding it. And it's actually not that far from where you are on Earth. And you should come and see me there because we're all waiting for you. He says, open your eyes. It's only a few hundred million miles. Don't you see it? And you see her look up into the sky and she can see this whole place that's built. And he says, don't you see your home? You've suffered long enough on Earth. Finally, your exile is over. Join us. Your new life awaits. Don't be afraid. Meet it with me and your mother at your side. And you see a picture of her mother, who is now like a Brainiac, wow, cyborg superwoman. Mm. and there's a whole bunch of others behind them. And so that's the way this issue ends. But I do feel like this is a book that is now close enough to what you're seeing on TV. Maybe not with the supporting cast members yet or things like that, but I think you're going to see all of that stuff start to sort of fall in line. And it's a good adventure. And this first story is a very emotional one with Kara, you know, potentially meeting her father again. Yep. And so interesting stuff. So I've been enjoying that book. And talking about a DC property.
Perfect segue.
Is a perfect segue into our boob tube where we're going to talk about the crossover. Now, we're going to do this a little bit backwards because we're going to do Supergirl last. Mm-hmm. Now, if you watch the crossover, then you know that the Supergirl episode was not even really a part of the crossover. The last 30 seconds were.
Yes. Like we joke about a crossover comic, because right. that was a lot of the jokes on Facebook from a lot of comic book friends going, hey, it's like I just bought a tie-in and got a panel.
Right.
Because
that's basically what it was. Like what you saw throughout the Supergirl episode is the breaches almost opening and then closing.
Yep.
Almost opening and then closing. And then right at the last part of the episode, you see Barry and Cisco come through and they into Kara's apartment, and that's how it ends.
Yes.
And then the crossover proper begins with the Flash. That is where the Dominators first show up. And this is a crossover that was based on the Invasion storyline, which I did not read, but you have read, correct?
Yep, 1988 or 89, I believe it was. And it was interesting because it started out, the whole thing started with a newspaper-sized comic that came out, Daily Planet with Invasion, and I still have that. And I remember I just flipped through it a little while ago, where it was a newspaper article. You open it up, and it's a whole thing based on this invasion of these aliens that are coming in. They've got big red spots on their face. And the aliens in that were more like the Mars Attacks aliens in the – not in the movie, but more in the card set, a little more serious looking. That look was certainly there. But the series I thought was okay back then, the comic one. It was kind of that way just to put everybody together, all the villains together, all the heroes together, because instead of fighting each other, we're now obviously fighting for our world. And that happened in this one where with Flash, you have Wally who's now got his powers.
And wants to use them.
And wants them. And everybody's trying to back him off because he's being a little fired up about this, a little too over-emotional, overzealous.
Well, Joe is so worried about what could happen to him. And also the fact that they're worried that maybe Alchemy was the one that gave him the powers and he's going to succumb to some sort of evil call or something like that.
Yep.
But more so that just that he's going to get himself hurt or killed because he's seen all the stuff that Barry's gone through, that he's been pushing back against Wally using his powers at all.
And we have Caitlin, who her powers have now manifested.
Yes.
And she's now wearing dampeners that are keeping them at bay because she was told by her mother, the more you use them, the more they're going to take you over.
Right.
So they had their
and
moment.
And we've seen some of that happen, but she was able to sort of fight through it with Cisco's help and stuff like that. But she is wearing them because she doesn't want to lose control.
And Cisco is now completely pissed off at Barry because of the fact that they have now heard this report they've heard the audio of Barry saying that he went in, and now it's before he told Cisco he went in and changed everything. Now he's hearing it, and Cisco is very angry at Barry.
Well, Cisco found out before everybody else. He found out early on when Barry started coming clean about the Flashpoint stuff and when details started to leak out that his brother Dante was alive previously, and because of Flashpoint is now dead. And so that basically made him not be able to forgive Barry for the choices that he's made. And it's been kind of a downer this season because Cisco is the humor of that team. He is the one who is always cracking the jokes, is always naming the supervillains. Now, H.W., Harrison Wells, has become that this season.
Like him.
I adore Tom Cavanaugh.
Yes, but I don't like this.
I love the fact that he's getting to play yet another version. This is the third version of himself that he gets to play on this show. And the thing that I like about it is you don't trust him.
No, because
you still are waiting. Yep. And that is further exacerbated from this week's episode of The Flash, but we won't talk about that. That was the midseason finale. But in this one here, you're right. What happens was Cisco's already pissed off at Barry. Barry is slowly telling a couple people here and there, but then he finds, or they find, a recorder from the future that basically is Barry warning them that, you know, bad things are happening because of the stuff that he's done and they can't trust him and all that kind of stuff. And they make a decision. He and Oliver and is it Diggle?
And Diggle, because Diggle finds out that he had a daughter.
Right.
In this previous life, not a son. And he completely freaks out about it. But the whole, like, what happens is that Barry has to go because a spaceship, as this is happening, a ship lands in the middle of Central City. Barry goes to investigate it. And when he does, he is overrun by these aliens that just, the door opens and they bolt.
Dominator's running out.
They bolt out. And it was a really cool looking scene to see that happening, to see that going on. And now you kind of have to put everything aside. And when they come and they have to, they realize they've got to build a team. That's why they bring Supergirl. They get Oliver, they get his team. But everybody is starting to find out, like all of a sudden Diggle's like, whoa, wait, what? I had a daughter and now I don't. And he's getting all bent out of shape. They're not trusting Barry. And it comes down to Oliver being the voice of reason saying, look, I would have done the same thing if it was me and I had a chance to go back and save my dad and save the guy on the boat that they shot, that his father killed, and all these people, and his fiance, he would have done it. So, and he's like, but I just didn't have the powers. So everybody's kind of getting a little calmer about the whole thing. But there is still a serious mistrust.
Well, yeah. And so what ends up happening is Ollie and Barry end up staying back while the rest of the team goes to free the president, I believe.
Yes, that's right, because the president got kidnapped.
And the president got kidnapped. So they go to free the president, and they all end up getting mind-controlled by the Dominators. And so the Flash episode basically ends with Flash and Green Arrow having to fight the rest of the team,
yep,
which was pretty awesome. There's a great moment where the two of them are against a wall and Supergirl's heat vision comes literally through
awesome.
The middle. And Green Arrow's like, what the heck was that? Oh, that's heat vision.
Yep.
And so that was really awesome. So the first one was a lot of setup and a lot of the team coming together and the team not trusting each other and a setup for a much larger fight.
Yes.
And then at the end of that one, when they're able to free the team from their mind control, what ends up happening is basically everybody that's affiliated with the Arrowverse gets kidnapped,
yep,
and sucked into the Dominator's spaceship. And the Dominators are there because the metahuman presence on Earth has got to a level where they think that it's a threat.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we find out later that they know about Barry messing with the timeline, which is the type of power that seems really threatening because you can affect all of reality with
and
that.
They were there, and the Dominators, they mentioned and showed video that
were there in the 50s. Yeah.
And they took out an entire group of soldiers.
Yep.
100, I think it was like over 100 were killed.
Which comes up again in the Legends episode. Mm-hmm. So now we go into the Arrow episode. In the Arrow episode, you have pretty much the Arrow group that is now on a Dominator ship, and they're hooked up to essentially the holodeck.
Yes.
Where all of them are in, it's almost like a Black Mercy type of situation.
That's exactly what I got out of it.
You are there and supposed to be kept sort of peaceful and sedated as in your mind you live out your wildest dreams. However, you are just in this little, you know, suspended animation chamber for eternity or until they do whatever they need to do with you. And so what we get is the return of Laura Lance,
mm-hmm,
where you have her and Ollie about to get married. Like it's the day before that they're going to get married. And so Diggle's there and Thea's there. And
Ollie's father and mother are there.
Ollie's father and mother are there. Sarah's there. You know, Captain Lance is going to be his father-in-law.
Merlin is there.
Yeah, Malcolm Merlin's there.
Like, everybody.
Deathstroke shows up. Like,
that was insane.
Of course.
I did not expect that.
Well, I know Manu's not the guy behind the mask anymore, but yep, it was cool to see Deathstroke, yep, sort of show up again. And so you have everybody gathering together at the Queen Estate for the marriage of Ollie and Laurel. And so he ends up, as the episode goes on, and I thought they did a good job with it. It was Arrow's 100th episode, and we talked about that last, when we recorded last, mm-hmm, because, you know, Stephen Amell had posted about that, and he was really thankful for, you know, the fact that they've gotten to 100 and getting everybody back together. And he was saying how Katie Cassidy, who plays Laurel, had actually been filming another project and took time to shoot down there and do the scenes that they needed to do in order to make this happen and to be a part of this, which was really super cool. And so it's a heartbreaker, man.
The whole episode is.
I mean, it really is a heartbreaker because you have everybody happy. You have Felicity still working with Arrow, but Arrow is Diggle.
Yes.
And there's a great moment where Ollie ends up stumbling across the Arrow lair and Diggle almost beats the crap out of him. And it's awesome.
Now, was that team of Ragman and Wild Dog and
Ragman, Wild Dog, Mr. Terrific.
Mr. Terrific. Are they on Arrow all the time now?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Because I'm sitting there going,
dude, I've been telling you,
I know
you need
have,
to watch
I haven't watched the season yet. Yeah. I have, and
the, you need
the,
to watch
the
it.
The whole thing was when, like,
Artemis
I'm looking,
is part of
yes,
the team. Yes.
When I was looking at the, or when they had the Ragman there, and I'm looking going, I don't even know who these people are supposed to be. And then the guy started talking about, well, the Torah explains that. And I'm like, oh my gosh, is that Ragman? And then 5 seconds later, he's in costume and it was Ragman, because Ragman is like that. The DC's openly Jewish character.
Right.
So when him mentioning the Torah, I'm like, that's Ragman. This is freaking awesome. Or I thought it was the monolith. It could have been either one, but Ragman, it was perfect. And the sad part, the heartbreaking part was Thea not wanting to go.
Yes.
Thea's like, look, I don't care what's going on. This feels real and I want to stay.
I thought that of the three episodes, the Arrow one was the best one.
This one was, yeah.
And it was because it had this great balance. Like the scenes that involved the crew back on our Earth were great.
Yep.
Because you had Barry and Supergirl, because they ended up needing this piece of technology. And is it Cyberwoman? Is that
yes.
is that the character who took this technology and sort
and
of made her,
it into herself.
Yeah, made herself into a cyborg. But there's a great scene where Wild Dog and Barry and Kara go to, you know, battle her. And Wild Dog doesn't trust metahumans, but of course they get there and he's getting the crap beat out of them. And then Barry and Supergirl show up and they have this awesome tag team moment.
Yeah.
Where
yep.
they literally
it
tag
was a literally
each other.
Tag, yep.
They tag in and it was awesome. And they end up finishing her off together. And that's the kind of stuff where as a comic book fan and as someone who, you know, wants to see these characters on screen, like those were awesome. Like yeah. overall. And so in that episode, of course, but the main story is that Oliver and Diggle and, you know, Ray Palmer,
Thea and Ray Palmer,
they all start to figure out that what is happening to them is not real, even as much as they want it to be. And so they end up having to make the choice that they need to break free from this thing. And they figure out that the way to get out of this simulation is to go to, Felicity's company.
Smoke Company or whatever her last name
yeah,
is.
Yeah, yeah, Smoke Technologies or whatever it is. And that's the way that they're going to get out of there. And so, but when they go to enact that plan, he's got to deal with his parents.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has to convince Thea, who doesn't want to leave because she knows that it's a simulation and basically says to Ollie, I don't care.
Yep.
Why don't we just stay here? Like, this is everything we ever wanted. Why are we going to go back to our crappy lives where all of these people are gone? And be in the, we're freaking invaded by aliens and all this other kind of, like, why are we going to go back to that? And so for a moment, he thinks that they're going to leave her there. And then, of course, she ends up kind of making the choice to come with them, even though it's not what she wants to do. And so that was great. But the moments with Ollie and Laurel and,
yeah.
you know, her not wanting him to leave and not understanding why he needs to leave and stuff like that, brutal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was brutal enough the first time around. When she passed away in last season of Arrow, but now twice as brutal.
And the sisters being back together.
Oh, absolutely.
That was the other part
yeah,
where it was like, cool.
Just like brutal.
Yep.
And so they end up breaking free. They end up realizing that they're in a Dominator ship. And then that sets up the next, and that brings in the Legends of Tomorrow because the Legends end up rescuing them.
In space.
In space. And it's Captain Steel. Or yes. Citizen Steel or whatever.
I think he's going by Captain Steel.
Yeah, I think they're just calling him Steel yep. in this one. But I haven't been watching Legends. That's the one I haven't been watching this season. So obviously the third episode is the big showdown. And that is the one where you have the fight with the Dominators. Basically, they go back in time to 1951 when the Dominators first showed up, and they end up, you know, letting one go, and he ends up kind of helping them a little bit later on. But you get the huge fight. The Dominators at one point have an ultimatum where they say that Barry is going to have to turn himself over, and then they'll leave. If Barry turns himself over, they'll leave. If not, they're going to enact this weapon that's going to destroy a whole bunch of people and places and all that other kind of stuff. And Barry's going to let himself go. He's going to let them take him. And of course, the team stops him from doing that. There was a great storyline in the Legends episode with Professor Stein when they come back to their time. Now, he has a daughter.
Yes.
And she is grown up and she is a scientist like him. And he knows that this only happened because in a previous episode, and everybody says, oh, well, was it Barry's thing that did it? No, he did something in the timeline where he spoke to his younger self.
Yes.
And ended up having a daughter. And so he, in that episode of Legends, is dealing with the fact that he's trying not to get close to her. And he's trying not to even be around her because he knows he's going to have to go back and fix this. And that's sort of the difference between how like Legends, they're trying to fix problems that have, you know, happened in the timeline. With Barry's situation, Barry's only going to make it worse if he tries to fix it.
Yep.
And so you had that sort of situation going on. There's a great moment in the third episode where Cisco and Felicity saved the day together, and it was totally awesome. So you have the Dominators are going to drop this bomb. Firestorm ends up transmuting the bomb into, I think it was water that he turns it into, but there's the big fight scenes. And the cool thing about the big fight scene that happened is that in the fight scene, there's a direct, I thought, nod to the airport scene in Captain America Civil War. It was kind of like them doing the version of what we saw in the, like basically saying, you guys have your big screen thing, but on TV,
this will be us.
This is us. This is our superhero team up. And they, I thought they did a nod to that. I don't know if other people interpreted that as the same thing, but that of course was cool. So the big bite action scene happens in that episode. The device that Stein and his daughter developed is what Supergirl and Barry are able to place on the Dominators in order to get them to sort of retreat. And they end up winning the day and all this kind of stuff. And then they have sort of the superhero wrap up party after, where everybody's sort of celebrating the victory and stuff like that. Cisco develops a device that will now allow Kara to communicate with and even travel to their world. So we've established that now. So Kara can come into the Flash universe
anytime she wants.
Whenever she wants. You have Cisco, who forgives Barry and basically says, you're my friend, when Barry was about to give himself up. So that piece of the storyline sort of ends up getting resolved. You have a great moment, and my favorite moment of the whole thing is afterwards, when they're all sitting around after they've sort of won the day, you have Kara come up in her civilian clothes and she's talking to Felicity, and Felicity's like, it's like looking in a mirror.
Yeah.
Which was awesome. And then as they walk away, she's talking to Ray Palmer, who's Brandon Routh. And he says, and I pulled out the quote, he says,
it's great.
He says, you know what's funny? She really looks like my cousin. And I like started clapping when they did that. And Parker was like, what's so funny about that? That I'm like, oh, dude, because he was Superman in the Superman Returns. And it was just awesome.
Yeah, it was. There were a couple nods that they made, because there was one in the other ones where I think he made a comment like, wow, I kind of feel like this must be what Superman feels like.
Right.
Or something like that, where it was like, holy cow.
Yeah, super cool stuff. And so, you know, the storyline overall I thought was – well done. I would say it was a 7 out of 10 in terms of story. It was a little uneven in parts. It was maybe not as action-packed as you would have liked it to have been. And I thought they really didn't know what to do with Supergirl in that story. Mm. They didn't have enough for her to do. They didn't have enough for her to really – because, again, she's much like an iconic, super powerful character, they can overpower the whole story. Yep. So that's the balancing act, right? Is how do you just not have Supergirl come in and kick the crap out of everything and have that be resolved in 5 minutes?
And what they did, I think, a really good job is it certainly did feel unbalanced, but I think what they did was really keep each show close to the heart and style of what that show was. Like, if you were watching The Flash, everybody acted like it was a Flash episode. And when you were watching Arrow, everybody acted like it was an Arrow episode.
Yes.
And Legends of Tomorrow, because Legends seems to be a little more open and free. Arrow is a little more angry and jaded.
Legends is absolutely the most swashbuckling of the shows. I think Flash has the most humor.
Yep.
Supergirl has the most hope and sort of optimism.
Perfect.
And you have Arrow, which is very much darker than all of those other shows. And the cool thing is like when you have Barry and Ollie get together, there is this, he lightens Ollie.
Yes, he does.
You know, he has that. And you also have Barry, who's in a place where he's really doubting himself, and who better to sort of be his mentor and give him advice than Ollie. And I love that relationship between the two of them.
Yep.
I also love, love, love the relationship between Kara and Barry.
Yes.
It's very much brother and sister. It's very much like when everybody else was pissed at Barry and was and had found out that he had lied to them and he had gone back and changed the timeline and everything, you know, her first comment to him is like, I always trust you, you know, yeah. And like that kind of stuff to me, there was so that's where like overall as a crossover, the moments far outweigh any problems that I might have with the story or the execution of it. Like there are some wonderful moments. Yes. On all of those episodes. And so, so overall, fantastic crossover. Like, do this every year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, absolutely have a nice, big, fun storyline that you can do. And the fact that they have four shows that they have the luxury of doing that with is mind-bogglingly awesome.
And I was hoping that they were going to bring Kara into this world, but I like
permanently.
I like the fact better that it's an alternate universe because you can now play around a little bit more with the or different world.
And she doesn't, and they don't have to get bogged down with. Do we have to match the tone of the other? Because we just talked about how the optimism, hope, what that symbol stands for, you know, when you think of Superman and Supergirl, to me, like that and what Supergirl has become to this point is just different than those other shows. Yep. And I wouldn't want them to feel beholden to any of those other shows because it needs to be its own thing. And that's actually a great segue into what we're going to talk about now. So the reason that we stuck Supergirl to the last one is because A, it wasn't really part of the crossover, right? There was a lot of stuff going on in that Supergirl episode and it ended up at the last minute sort of being a tie-in there, but it was the Thanksgiving episode of Supergirl. And so as we get into Supergirl, you had the Thanksgiving dinner that was about to happen and you had a few different sort of storylines going on. Number one is you had James and you had Wynn who wanted to talk about the fact that James is the Guardian now, right? And he was going to tell everybody that. That was going to be his big thing. And you've got Kara's mother, Eliza, who's there, Kara and Alex. And you have Alex who has been dealing with her sexuality and her sexual identity over the past few, I would say several episodes now. And she was going to come out to the family at Thanksgiving. And that was the big announcement that she was going to tell everybody. And so you start off in this place where everybody has a story that they want to share. Everybody wants to talk about something. And then you throw Mon-El into the mix.
Yeah.
And Mon-El clearly has feelings for Kara, but Kara doesn't believe that that's even possible because they have that rivalry between Daxam and you know, and Krypton to begin with. And so you have all these sort of competing things. And then a breach shows up in the middle of the conversation and nobody gets to spill their news about anything. So as the episode goes on, what you see is that there is a virus that has been created that kills aliens. And so the bar that we've been seeing throughout the season where all of the aliens go to hang out and where, you know, Jean met McGann, you know, before.
Which has been a great little story in between and that too.
We see that Cyborg Superman has shown up and he is Hank Henshaw.
Yeah.
And so he has this weapon that he goes in that was, I think, helped to be developed by Cadmus. And he goes in and releases it in this bar and kills all the aliens in the bar. And so you had Mon-El who was there and got partially exposed to it. And so he gets really sick and he's back at the DEO and he's, you know, receiving a lot of medical attention and they're very worried about whether or not he's going to make it. And it comes to find out that that virus was manufactured with Kara's blood.
Yes.
And so she knows that Cadmus is behind this. She also knows that the leader of Cadmus is Lena Luthor's
mother
is the leader of Cadmus. And so she's trying to get a bead on Cadmus through Lena. And Lena takes that as an insult because she thinks that she's getting lumped in with the Luthor name and all that kind of stuff. And so, but what's happening is Cadmus needs this particular technology or this particular, enzyme or whatever in order to be able to weaponize this whole virus. And they're basically going to kill Supergirl and everybody else with it or all the other aliens or anything. And so the episode becomes about, is Lena bad or not? Is she going to work with her mother? Is she going to turn bad? Is she going to be part of Cadmus? And it seems like she's going to at one point, and then she ends up betraying her mother. And that was kind of a cool thing that, that happened with that particular storyline. But there's, you know, parts where Hank thinks that he's going to be dead now because he's exposed to this stuff. And of course that doesn't end up happening. And so that whole storyline resolved itself really, really well. However, the storyline that finally came to fruition in this episode in a couple of different places was the whole Alex storyline. And there is an awesome moment that she has with her mom where she has been struggling with wanting to tell her mom, with wanting to come out. And there's just a great moment where, you know, Eliza basically tells her, I knew, you know, I knew just by the way that you were talking about Maggie that clearly you had feelings for her. And of course I love you. And it's just an awesome, great moment. And then of course, at the end of the episode, you have Maggie and Alex finally getting together. And so, you know, Alex is in a place now where she's told Maggie how she feels about her. Maggie kind of thought that was a lot to take on at first because she's the person that she's come out to.
Yeah.
So that puts a lot of pressure on their relationship. And by the end of the episode, Maggie comes back to her, you know, and they have their first kiss and everything like that. And it's an awesome moment and just sort of so well earned through the storyline that's been going through this particular season. And to me, like that has just been fantastic to see that. Like Alex, first of all, Alex has a fantastic story arc this season. And to see the arc that she's getting on Supergirl it's just been great.
Yeah.
So like this season of Supergirl, to me, the show has taken a giant leap forward in terms of its storytelling, in terms of the arcs that it has for different characters, and the stuff that has been happening so far this season with the Alex and Maggie storyline has been just fantastic.
And what I loved about that whole thing, and it was really, it made me sad when Alex came out to her mom, because her mother, who was Supergirl in the original, in the 80s and 90s.
Right, you could never forget that.
No.
Right? Yeah.
She took it so well, and that is not the case for everybody else, and that really made me sad watching that, where, you know, you just come out and say something that is literally life-threatening, earth-shattering, everything has changed, and she's like, oh my gosh, I knew all that, I love you, blah, blah, blah. That's not the way it is for everybody, and that really made me sad to think that this is what people have to deal with. And the other thing that I really took out of that whole relationship with Maggie and with Alex, and I was not liking Maggie. I'm like, Maggie is screwing this girl over. She's stringing her along. I was getting all bent out of shape about Maggie. Then when Maggie came in and explained the whole thing about the pressure it put her under, made complete sense. But the relationship between the two, what I loved about it was it has never been sexual. It's all emotional. And I love that fact. Like they weren't going for the, oh, we're going to go for that, you know, the quick hit just to get that audience in there. It was a long-term emotional thing. Like there were, every time you'd see Alex, I used to be thinking like, this is a girl that's got it all together. And now I'm like, this poor girl is struggling with this identity crisis she's having. And to have it all resolved was amazing. But I love the fact that they really played so well on the emotional side of it. Instead of the, you know, hey, it's going to be two girls kissing. This is, hey, these are two women that are going to be able to get what they want in life, and that's each other. And
I think the difference is with that is that it's not written for – it is written for exactly the audience that it needs to be written for, is that it's written for people who need to see this in a show. They need to see characters that are struggling with the same issues as them, and it's an important storyline.
Yeah.
And – To me, it was very emotional watching that. But also, when you hear this is
you warned me about this one. So
I was reading a story this past weekend, and it was mentioned on the beat. Heidi McDonald did a great write up of this, and she starts by saying, rather than embed a giant string of tweets, just go to this one and read the story that unfolds. And so on Twitter the other day, and I was reading the story as it was on Twitter. I'm going to read you a story by a woman by the name of Mary, and she had posted this on Twitter, and she said, so I want to tell you what happened in the store today. She works at a comic book store. She said, it's probably the single greatest moment I have ever experienced working here. Now, I'm just as a preamble here, I'm just going to read exactly as she wrote this particular story, because it was over a series of at least like a dozen tweets. So I'll just read this. So she says, I want to tell you all what happened at the store today. It's probably the single greatest moment I've ever experienced working here. After the usual Saturday rush, a teenage girl comes in. She looks absolutely terrified, and when I greet her, she jumped. She said she starts going up and down the new release wall, and the poor thing looks completely overwhelmed. So I make my way over to her and I ask her if I can help her find anything. She quietly admits that she was looking for Supergirl. So we're walking to the super area where I asked her if she watches the show. She smiles a bit and nods. She says Alex is her favorite. I mentioned that I'm a huge Sandverse shipper. Now, on Twitter, the Maggie Sawyer and Alex Danvers hashtag is Sandverse. It's the two of them together. Yep. So everybody who is in favor and wanting to see this relationship happen has been using that hashtag to talk about it. And I can tell you that that hashtag has really been very important to people who are talking about their own stories of coming out and talking about just the representation that they're seeing on the show and what a positive thing it is and all that kind of stuff. So she says, I mentioned that I'm a huge Sandverse shipper and the poor thing just breaks down in tears. I'm trying to figure out what the heck I did to upset her. She's crying and I'm freaking out. After a minute or so, everything clicks. She says, I'm staring down at a crying baby gay, one who was having some big issues. I tell her it was hard for me when I wanted to come out too. She finally stops crying and asks me if it gets easier. We sit at the coffee bar and talked for a while. She tells me that after seeing it all over Tumblr, she binge watched Supergirl. And when she got to Alex's coming out, that was when things hit her. She tells me that she just wanted to kill herself for so long. I'm sorry, I'm getting emotional reading this. She had tried, but she had just made herself sick. But as Alex's arc continued, she said that she realized that she started to see that she could be happy and that she could be loved. She didn't want to die anymore. For the first time, she didn't want to die because she got to see Alex being amazing and being queer. She said that she came to the store hoping to find something to get her through the hiatus so she wouldn't fall back into depression. She had no idea gay comic characters were a thing, but I wanted to try. I told her about Batwoman. I told her about Midnighter. I told her about Renee Montoya. I pull out my starters, which are Batwoman Elegy, Midnighter, and Gotham Central. I dug up a copy of Adventures of Supergirl just to get her through. She had enough cash for one and was torn on which to get. She decides on Batwoman and asks if I can hold the rest for a while. I was having an internal crisis at the time because this kid was me years ago. I was barely holding off my own tears. I ended up buying the other three for her, and I made her promise to me that in 10 years she'll help another queer kid. So I'm out $60, and I cried in the bathroom for an hour, but it was damn worth it. She said, and she used the Twitter handles for the CW Supergirl and Supergirl staff, which is the writer staff, Shyler Lee, who plays Alex, and Floriana Lima, who plays Maggie. She said, the work that you do means so much to us. Thank you so, so much. Batwoman saved me years ago. I found her in 2006, and I have never stopped taking strength from her. I am here today because of that strength. And then after that, people had shared that story with Shyler Lee, and she had tweeted, this is amazing. Please read this thread from Sapphic Geek, which is the Twitter handle of this woman, Mary. This is what real life Supergirl looks like. All we need is love, respect, and kindness. And then the Supergirl Writers Room, which is its own account, said, thanks to all who shared this thread with us. It means a lot to hear the impact of our words. Lots of love from the super crew. Wow. So I have cried literally every time that I've read that story. And so Heidi McDonald over at The Beat started her write-up of this saying, rather than embed a giant string of tweets, just go to this one and read that story, which I just read you. She said, written by a comic shop clerk, it's about how a teen girl came into the store in search of some comics to help her find her way in the world and how she cried when the clerk helped her. It had to do with the character of Alex Danvers on Supergirl, who has been revealed to be gay and exploring a romance with a longtime LGBTQ character, Maggie Sawyer. And in this relationship, the young woman finding her own sexuality found role models to show her how to be happy in her own life when it seemed very bleak before. Thanks to the clerk Mary, the girl walked out with copies of Batwoman, Gotham Central, Supergirl, and Midnighter. Mary purchased three of them herself. And Heidi goes on to say, this is why representation in comics, in television, in films, everywhere is so important. It saves lives. It brings hope. It makes this a stronger, better world. When I write a story about a comic with a protagonist who isn't a typical white male, there are inevitable comments about how these characters don't resonate with old-timey comics readers. She said, well, guess what? Not everything has to be for old-timers. Maybe they can be satisfied with the 75% of characters in films who are white and the 70% who are male. I don't know the numbers for superhero comic book characters, but I'm guessing it's similar. Making comics where the protagonists are not all the same isn't a fantasy. It's just how the world works. It's a scary time for a lot of people around the world, and now we still need role models. Superhero comics have always been aspirational, and they need to represent all people on the entire spectrum of race, creed, and gender. Even if it's a message that saves one person out there, it's worth it. After this tweet story got huge exposure, it was suggested that people donate to Equality Florida, an organization that's dedicated to securing full equality for Florida's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. I'd suggest the same, or buy a comic for someone that you think might like it or need it. So that's pretty heavy stuff.
It is.
And it's to have watched that episode of Supergirl and been very emotional about it. Not only because of personal things in my own life, but because of the kids that I've worked with for years in my own line of work was very, very powerful to me. And then to read that story to me, like, the again, that type of representation could save somebody's life.
Yep.
Telling a story that's inclusive, telling a story that that again has things that you know from your own life. I mean, and just being able to see that is fantastic. On a related note, David Johnson, who is the running back for the Arizona Cardinals, wrote a great article this past week about how he was bullied his entire childhood, and he now goes to school. It goes to schools all over the place and speaks and talks to kids about bullying and writes about his own experiences and things like that. Like, when you're a kid, man, and I have a 13-year-old daughter right now and a 10-year-old son, and it is amazing how terrified kids are sometimes to tell their own family.
Yep.
Anything. Not even things like struggling with your sex, but anything.
Uh-huh.
Things that they're struggling with school, things that they're afraid of, things that they are nervous about, things that they're having anxiety about. And to know that there are other people in the world that they can go to and have those conversations. Like, again, this person who worked in this comic book store was able to be there for a kid that needed it. And that show sparked that event happening. Had that storyline not happened on Supergirl, that kid never walks into that store. Yeah. That kid never has that conversation. That opportunity never arises. And that's a girl who said that she had already previously tried to kill herself.
And she's still
before.
In her head is still, that's where she is.
Right. So now coming out of there, she comes out of there with a friend, with someone who shared their own experience, with hope, with a place now, hopefully, that she can go, mm-hmm. where she knows that someone's going to be supportive to her. I mean, that kind of stuff is just heavy.
Yeah.
And amazing. So you can easily find more information about that story. I thought Heidi did an awesome write-up of that. I thought the initial story that Mary shared on Twitter was absolutely amazing. And I really do truly think that the work that they're doing on Supergirl and the storyline, and to Shirley Lee and to Floriana Lima, who are bringing that storyline to life, they are doing a phenomenal job.
Yep.
Of that. Like, just absolutely fabulous. So, you know, yet another reason to love Supergirl.
Yeah.
Like, that was a show that last year we were championing. And every time I talk about Supergirl, I talk about that scene where Barry showed up for the first time.
Yeah.
The ice cream. Did we talk about that last week?
Yes, we did. And the ice cream is the greatest scene ever.
And there's a GIF of it online.
Yeah.
That you can see every
it just keeps going
on Twitter.
And going.
It just keeps going and going. Like, I will never get sick of that.
Yeah.
I will never get sick of seeing a show that has hope.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, again, like, that's a show my whole family watches. Like,
yeah.
it to me, so many good things about that show. Anyways, I know we got heavy there for a second, but I did want to talk about that because that was amazing. And at least one amazing story has come out of that. And I know that's not the only one.
Yeah.
Because it's generating discussion. And that's what needs to happen. And so, so that is your wrap up of the CW crossover. There have been other episodes since then. All the shows are having their fall finales this week. Actually, I think that was Supergirl's fall finale, but for the other three, it was all this week, and we can talk about that next time. But that is going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. For Mr. Matthew Herring, who cried less than me today.
Yeah.
I think that's a milestone.
Yep.
That is a first. This is Brian Letenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week. We will talk to you in a few short days, and we are going to continue to try to get shows done around the holiday season and maybe even throw out, you know, a Christmas episode or something like that. So we will get that sorted out. But thanks for your patience, too, because we've got a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
And so as everybody does around the holidays. But It's been an interesting few weeks. So there you go. That's going to wrap up the show. Have a great rest of your week. We'll talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.